Where warp meets weft. Where warp meets weft. This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Happy New Year, and welcome to episode 12 of Weavecast, in which we'll talk with amazing and incredibly inspiring weaver Anita Luvera Mayer, hear a swatch of the day from Sharon Schultz, and finally finish things up with musings about New Year's resolutions for weavers. The holidays are behind us, and I hope that you, as I did, had just a wonderful time with your family. I don't know if you've heard about the big windstorm that hit the Seattle area, but we lost power for a week due to downed trees and branches, and it was actually a secret blessing because it gave us an extra week of family time. And of course, all my favorite occupations are pre-electricity, so it was darn, can't go out frantically Christmas shopping. Guess I'll have to stay home and weave. It was a really good holiday. February 1st, I'll be speaking to the Whidbey Island Weavers Guild. They've asked me to do a presentation about creating Weavecast, and since we're almost at the one-year anniversary of the show, it's great timing, and I'm very excited about that. So if you're a member of the Whidbey Island Weavers Guild, see you soon, and if you're not, I think they allow guests, so you could contact them if you're curious. I'd like to mention a weaving blog that I have been enjoying and finding very inspirational. It's Sandra Rood's. The URL will be up on the show notes, and she's an incredibly talented, complex weaver. Stunning things on her site. Go check it out. I've mentioned the Yahoo weaving lists on the show. I'd also like to mention the QuiltNet weaving list. It's very similar to the Yahoo group, but slightly different topics and well worth checking out if you're like me and can't get enough weaving lists. Again, the link will be on the show notes. Cynthia Cohen took time over the busy holiday season to put a donation in the Weavecast stocking. Thank you. And Marguerite Kaufman got a Podlines number for Weavecast. Now, what this is it's a telephone number that you can call to hear an episode of Weavecast. So if you have a friend who's interested in the show, but either doesn't have a computer or doesn't have broadband so that they can download the 50 megabyte files, tell them to check this out. The number is 1-650-644-1947, and that will also be up on the show notes. It's a very cool service. I tried it, and the sound quality is not CD crystal quality, but it's a telephone. And you can hear the show without a computer. So how cool is that? Thank you, Ms. Kaufman. On a personal note, my Secret Santa sent me some amazingly cool yarns to add to my stash. I was agog with happiness when I opened this box. Actually, Eric had to leave the room because I started doing the I Got New Yarn happy dance. I am overwhelmed by your generosity. Thank you. This episode, we welcome a new sponsor, Mud River Angoras. They're underwriting all the expenses associated with this episode of Weavecast, so thank you. This is another woman-owned business. Laura Lee Schultz raises German and Giant Angora rabbits and has their fiber processed for spinning and weaving. In addition, she also sells Ashford spinning fiber and other goodies. One of the coolest offerings on her site are these weaving kits featuring her Angora yarn. You get a pre-wound warp, weft, and instructions with a weaving draft. Now, if you're one of those folks who likes weaving more than you like winding warps, these can be a real time saver. She had one of her projects featured in the most recent Handwoven magazine, the January-February 2007 issue. It's a scarf that is done with bamboo and angora, and that's one of the kits she offers. She also offers some silk and angora kits that look really cool. Now, I asked for a yarn sample when she signed up to be a sponsor, because I want to make sure that anyone who is a sponsor on the show is selling a quality product. And because, let's face it, I'm a yarn mooch. She sent me a really luscious 2-ply, 80% Angora, 20% Merino, and 3,000 yards per pound. It is very soft. It feels like you're holding butter. She also sells 100% Angora weaving yarns, but she didn't have a sample in stock to send me because apparently it sells out pretty fast when she produces a run. And I hear she's currently taking pre-orders for a January shipment. Angora yarns, especially those thin enough to be good for weaving, are hard to come by. So I'm delighted to add Mud River Angoras to my personal list of yarn vendors, and I hope that you've enjoyed hearing about them as well. You can check out their website at www.mudriverangoras.com. And as always, there will be a link in the show notes. So I'm here in the studio with Anita Luvira Mayer. It is an incredibly rich and beautiful environment filled with ethnic textiles and inspirational pictures from magazines. And I am just amazed to be here. So thank you, Anita, for being on the show and inviting me into this lovely space. She is a textile artist with decades of experience and is known for creating rich art garments that represent themes, especially themes in women's lives, and that draw on ethnic textiles for inspiration. But before we dive into all that, I'm always curious, how did you get started in weaving?
This is my favorite story to tell, and totally true. I married Jack Mayer, the eldest of three sons of Marcel Mayer, who is a very well-known Seattle weaver. The woman had three looms in her living room, and though I didn't know what they were, it looked fascinating to me. And what this amazing woman did, as each of her three sons married, she gave each daughter-in-law a 36-inch floor loom and weaving lessons. It never took with the other two, but that gift to me has totally changed my life.
So no pressure from your mother-in-law to learn to weave there.
Someone pointed out to me years later that that was really quite presumptuous, but I'm the middle conforming child. So Marcel said, weave, I wove. I didn't know there were other options. I must add, as a weaver, however, that initially I was not smitten. I could see no real reason to do 8 placemats the same. I could see no reason to do 2 placemats the same. But being the dutiful daughter-in-law, I did persevere, which brought me to where I am today.
So how did you get from doing placemats to art garments?
Well, of course, there's a story on everything. I initially was trying to teach myself and went to the first convergence in Detroit, Michigan, the National Weavers Meeting in 1972. I had not been away from home in 12 years of marriage. We had no money. My children were 2, 4, and 8. I had been teaching myself to weave with Marcel's help and knew I needed to connect with other creative women and managed to get myself to Detroit. In one of the 2-hour seminars I took, it was on hand-woven clothing. And by then I had tried everything from rugs to hangings and wrote in my journal, June 1972, from this day forward, any major piece of clothing I wear, I will make. And that was the starting point.
Wow, that's such an inspiration. Such a high bar.
Well, it wasn't totally successful to begin with. And as I have some of my early pieces, including the horrendous green dress that was totally unsuccessful, although I didn't know that for 2 years and wore it. But we start somewhere.
So for those of us who haven't seen the green dress, could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I was initially thought I would weave yardage. I'd learned to sew when I was 12. And so it seemed logical to me to make yardage and sew it into garments. Except at that point in time, which is the mid-70s, I was weaving with very coarse threads. And of course, the minute scissors approached those threads, there was self-destruction of the fabric. But I thought I could persevere. So on the horrendous green dress, I wove the fabric, and indeed it did begin to ravel. So I very brilliantly edged all the cut edges with Elmer's glue, which, of course, when it dried, made a permanent rash on my body.
Oh, no.
So then I lined it and thought probably I was not as good a seamstress as I thought in terms of handwoven fabric. So it occurred to me if I could make very simple shapes, like the poncho, I could take links off the loom, put them together, and wear them. thinking I had discovered this brilliant process of not cutting into material. So that was the next step in my evolution.
So was that what inspired your book, Clothing from the Hands That Weave, that have a lot of loom-shaped garments in them?
Precisely. I was, by then, had done quite a body of work and knew Linda Ligon, at that time, the editor and owner of Interweave Press. She encouraged me to put together what I had been teaching in workshops on simple-shaped garments into a written format. And so I agreed to do that and remember well June 1st of the infamous year, realizing I had contracted to write a book and I'd never written a book before, but simply tried at that time, using a typewriter, to talk to the typewriter like I talked to the workshops. And I'd been doing workshops on that topic at that point, a good 7 or 8 years. The other interesting thing that occurred with the book was the introductory chapter, which talked about how I evolved into doing these kinds of garments. And I'd said that my goal was to wear on the outside who I was on the inside, to communicate who I was as a woman with my clothing. And there was more fascination with the introductory chapter talking about my pathway than really for the garments themselves. And that was a clue that I didn't quite understand initially, but grew to understand more fully as my work evolved.
Well, it's a very successful book. There aren't a lot of books about how to translate what comes off the loom into something that you can wear. So I appreciate you writing it. It's very clear. I love the images and diagrams. It was very easy to understand and follow. You wrote another book after that, Handwoven Clothing Felted to Wear. What was the inspiration for that?
Well, I thought I had discovered fold fabric, that is loosely woven material that you put into the washing machine or transform in some other manner to make it literally shrink or fold into a more stable fabric. And I worked on that for several years and was absolutely fascinated, was doing workshops on that same technique. And of course, the joy for me now was that I could make fabric, fold it or shrink it down. And then when the scissors approached the fabric, there was not total deconstruction and unraveling out. So I really thought I had found the magic ingredient and had so much information. I submitted it as an article for Handwoven Magazine. And it was really, there was too much material. And so I was encouraged then to put it into a book format. But by now, my son was a teenager, our three children were growing, and the first chapter then carried on the storyline of where I was as a woman in my work, in what I was creating and wearing. From the beginning, my clothing was a reflection of who I am. I think clothing is nonverbal communication, so I've always attempted to be forthright about what I'm saying with the clothes I weave and wear.
You've moved from the early days of ponchos and the JCPenney dress to stunning art garments now that are full of meaning and layers and richness. Was there a sudden revelation or was it a slow evolution?
I think it was a slow evolution, but I didn't know it for quite a while. The significant body of work that was the marker on this is the 6 garments I did called Mantles for Women, Rites of Passage. My father, an Italian immigrant with an 8th grade education, who came to this country and sent 3 children to college, strong, independent man. He was a state senator, wrote a book on how to carve totem poles at age 82. The Italian immigrant. But at 92, my father, because of declining health, chose to take his life. I was devastated. For the next 7 months, with the help of my amazing mother, I designed and made the first mantle, a long sleeveless vest that reverses, called Metamorphosis. And one side was all black fabrics and jet beads, which was death. And then it reversed to fabrics and reds, the blood of life. Once that was finished, I realized, at least for me, how the loss of the first parent is such a marker in a person's life. And I began to think about who I was as a woman and aging. The rest of that series began marking my passages as a woman. I still wasn't cognizant of the fact that my work was directly speaking to women's issues, but everything that has followed, looking backwards, which I always love, you know, you sort of place, you look backwards and think, oh my gosh, this is the trail I'm on. I began to recognize that It were my feelings as a woman as I got older, the importance of aging in this youth-oriented society. I had some things to say about it. And I think you have to live so many years before you have some things to say about aging and the role of women in this world.
I've noticed in whatever media, whether it's writing or weaving, that the deeply personal does tend to be universal. So you went deep into yourself and found things that resonated with other people. I think that's beautiful. Did making that mantle help you come to terms with your father's passing?
Absolutely. By the time I had completed that work, I had a totally different sensation and feeling and attitude about death and what death represents. Recognizing that my father did what he had always done in his life. When there was a problem, he looked at various solutions, chose one, and took action. I mean, it was an extraordinarily brave thing that he did. I began to look at other cultures and how they deal with death. And death is a celebratory time about the person's life. Every other culture of the world honors death in some manner, except in this country where we mourn and carry on. I think if death comes too early with someone young, that is quite one thing. But when someone has lived a full and complete life, why don't we honor where they are going next? And so my whole feeling about life and death changed with the making of that piece and the five mantles that followed.
I think it's a reflection of the youth culture that you mentioned, that death is the undeniable consequence of aging. Perhaps there's something in the American psyche that's, if we can just remain young forever, we don't have to face that there is an end. This is something that's been coming up for me too. I've just hit the middle year mark. And for the first time in my life, I realized that there does come to be an end and that you do only have a set number of years to work.
The more reading and talking to women, both in through my workshops, because this conversation goes on regularly, and seeing women in other cultures, what happens here is that we never really visually see what a 60, 70, or 80-year-old woman looks like, either on television, in magazines. They're airbrushed young. They're airbrushed thin. We don't really celebrate lines on the face that indicate you've lived and gnarled hands, gray hair. Why should these not be markers that we honor? Other cultures honor the elderly. They are used in a resourceful way. In the Indian culture of this country, it's the grandmothers who pass on the history of the clan and of the tribes. In other cultures, when you are elderly, you're a wise woman and you are cherished for that, but not here. And I am on a personal crusade to say passing age 50 is glorious. We need to honor every wrinkle and gray hair we have and just go forward sharing what we have learned with the generations that are coming behind us.
Amen.
Well, and again, I think it's sometimes more effective to say this in a visual way as through my clothing that I'm trying to make statements and I'm doing some wall pieces. Speaking about the women of the world in this very topic, we are just so inundated with words that I think we just stop listening. But maybe visually, if they see the garments or they see the wall pieces, it will provoke more thought on the topic.
Getting back to that, what are some of the other series? Because I know you've done several series, Mantles for Women. Can you describe the Shrouds project?
Yes, the Shrouds are a series of five stoles that wrap around the body that are reversible. And shroud means protective covering. And this began when my mother in her late 80s went into a residential center. Mother was fine mentally, but physically needed help. Most of the people in the facility were elderly women making strange sounds in another time and place. And for the first weeks of going to visit mother, I did not want to look at these women. And then one day it struck me that those women are all of us. They had dreams and lives and adventures and had made choices, and they needed to be revered and honored. And I decided to do a series that honored women. And the first one was called Reflections, and it's a piece that wraps around the body that has hundreds of cross stitches on it, representing the choices we make as women, dull fabrics, bright fabrics for the times of sadness and the times of joy that are a part of a woman's life. And I just continued that series to honor women of all ages, of all cultures. And again, it's a protective covering to give us warmth within and to honor women. The newest series that I'm working on are all dealing with using laces and doilies made by women. They've been sent to me by friends. I'm picking them up in secondhand stores, and then I am dyeing them and using them on contemporary garments. And that whole body of work is called Anonymous Women.
When you say you're dyeing the doilies, do you mean dip dyeing them? Or are you painting them?
I'm actually painting them with dye, so I have control over the color placement. So I'm collecting, they're all different sizes and types and beiges and whites. So then I can paint the dyes onto those. Then I'm appliquing them onto various fabrics and then adding beading and stitchery. Again, to take something that women made, and usually there is no name attached to that incredible handwork that women have put into embroidery and certainly crochet. Finding those treasures really, to me, then acknowledges who these women were. I don't know them personally, but their work is being carried on in a way in today's world. In one of the garments with the doilies within the lining, I have also transferred old photographs of women, I don't know who they are, onto tea-dyed handkerchiefs, so the women are within the garment itself.
I love how you take something that, I think all of us have a pile of cotton doilies that were made by grandmothers and great-grandmothers somewhere, and you're taking them and infusing them with color and then putting them into these rich garments. I think that's just a lovely way to reinvent and honor the things that have been made.
Well, it's been exciting, and it has connected me with women who have said, oh my goodness, I have my grandmother's doilies and I don't know what to do with them. Do you want them? And these amazing packages have been arriving on my doorstep. And as I just wrote to a friend this morning who said, do you need more doilies? That for me, once I start down a road then and do the first piece, the second piece, now I have 10 more ideas of ways to use the laces and doilies. So I'll probably be in that approach to clothing, certainly for a bit longer.
You wrote a journal called I Don't Do Guilt Anymore. What was the motivation behind that?
I was doing a lecture, and again, because of those introductory chapters of my two books, people had questions about my personal life, how I balance that with my creative time. You know, it's the old juggling act that most women deal with on a daily basis, whether they're working outside the home or they're a single parenting or they have small children. And what I discovered is that if I was truthful about who I was and my family situation in my workshops, it allowed other women to come forth and say out loud what was going on in their world. For a really long time, I thought my husband and I had the only, you know, child who got into drugs and was a challenge and we were trying to keep in school, because literally everyone I knew or talked to had perfect marriages and perfect children. And the Christmas letters were enough to make me weep. And that's not where my life was. And so I've decided that Jack and I were obviously the only two ineffectual parents. And the first time I talked out loud about the challenges with our 16-year-old, women came forth and shared their stories and their suggestions and their support. It was like this whole amazing world had opened up. And so the more truthful I was, the more women came forth and shared their stories. It was like suddenly, finally, we could talk about these things. It didn't mean we necessarily solved them, but to have that intimacy with women, and I didn't even know them that well, it was like wrapping our arms around each other and saying, we will indeed survive and get through this. Then that led to a lecture called I Don't Do Guilt Anymore, which was simply putting on the table my life to that point, from marriage counseling to raising children to trying to find money and time to weave. People wanted it in written form. So again, I simply sat down and talked to the computer and put what I'd been saying in the lecture into written format. I self-published that book, or I am still publishing it, actually. And it simply amazes me because it's always been word of mouth. Probably 8,000-9,000 copies have now been sold just one at a time, and someone buys them for their daughter-in-law, or someone else gets them as gifts, or they've lost their copy and want another. And that was absolutely a revelation to me, that when you're honest about yourself, the majority of people don't just cringe and walk away from you because you're strange. They say, they reach out a hand and say, oh, I've been there too, or this is where I am. There is someone else. And because I could verbalize it, then of course it transformed into the clothing. So now I'm wearing what I believe and what I'm saying, and trying to be honest about that.
Well, the interesting thing about that booklet is not only the stuff that you say and the marvelous quotes that you have, but you also made it a journal so that part of it is blank for the person to write their own reflections in. What caused you to do that?
Well, for years, I keep two types of journals, actually. I have what I call my design journal, just a small booklet that's with me 24 hours a day. And when I hear something or see something or that brilliant thought that someone shares, it goes into that. The eclectic collection of things that touch my heart, touch my mind, that I always laugh and tell my classes, the sort of thing you think you'll never forget. And by the time I'm out the door, I've forgotten it. At the same time, for a long time, I keep almost a daily journal, maybe 10 minutes of writing, highlighting the weather, what happened that day, where I am in my life, very quick. And because of Simple Abundance by Sarah Brecknock book, I do a daily reading, and she encourages one to write down their five gratitudes every day. And some days that is very difficult. I mean, the fact that I got out of bed some days is simply all I have to say, because as you know, we all have good times, bad times. Right. So I have found journaling on any level so important to determine where I am, where I've been, and where I'm going, that I wanted to provide a place for women to do that too. So the back half of the book of I Don't Do Guilt are blank pages with encouraging quotes for people. And the other thing we did is that each page on the journal has an additional warp drawn on and the opportunity for people to visually weave their lives, because that's what journaling is about.
I noticed that. It's a very cool little graphic along the side.
My graphic artist is just an amazing woman, and my sister edited for me, and without Kathy Hastings and my sister Phyllis, none of these books would have happened.
Now, if somebody was interested in obtaining a copy of that, how would they find it?
They can obtain it through me or through the Weaving Works in Seattle. I probably won't publish it again. I'm down to my last 100 copies. And my life has changed since then. And whether I do an addenda or not, I don't know. Something else will evolve.
In a recent talk to the Seattle Weavers Guild, you had brought some of your design journals, and they were filled with pictures and drawings and notes. How have your journals impacted your work?
I've had design journals for probably 20 years, just the eclectic, again, collection. I went back to school 9 years ago now, I guess it's been, in a program called City and Guilds, which is offered in Oak Harbor. It's a program out of England on embroidery and design. Part one was 3 years of going to class and doing a huge quantity of work on design and embroidery, 1 year off, and then 12 of us were foolish enough, if you will, to do part two, which was 4 years. And this was how to be creative. I said to a number of people, in fact, I've done articles about that course, for me, what it was, because I had no art school background, it gave me the language in which to share what was in my soul. And the only analogy I can use with people is, if I had this amazing story to tell a group of Chinese women, but I can't tell it because I do not speak Chinese, is where I really was with the things I wanted to say in my work, and I did not know how to do it, technically or creatively. And what those 7 years gave me were the tools in which to do that. And one of the ways that we worked through that class is, once we defined a project, a specific piece we were going to create, there was all kinds of research done, and we would do large format design journals. So each time I'm doing a major piece, I get just a spiral bound book. And I start putting into it my ideas, and I go back through my small design journals, pull things. I start putting together in one book any of the inspiration or ideas for the particular project at hand. And that just gives me the ability to be wide open to options. So each major piece has its own notebook of reference.
And then once you've gotten your reference book compiled, how do you use that to make a garment?
Then I have to figure out how to do what it is I have designed in the notebook, whether it's what dyes to mix for the colors, what kind of fabric I'm going to use. Am I going to weave it or use commercial fabric? How will I handle the edges? Will I line it in what way? So really, 80% of my time is before and after doing the garment per se. By the time I've done the sampling, figured out the patterning, done all of the different steps to be certain I am saying what I want to say, that's the greatest portion of the time involved in a piece. The designing takes an extraordinary amount of time, but I have learned, for me at least, the more time I spend in that phase, the more likely the garment will say what it is I want to say. So I generally have three things happening in my studio. I am designing one piece. I'm doing the major kind of work on a second piece, and I'm doing the hand finishing on the third piece. Or it might be designing, weaving the fabric, and the finishing. So there's three things going on, or three garments being done at the same time. I don't have 20 projects going. My head doesn't work that way. I only can focus really intensely on one thing at a time, which is always the piece I'm designing. That takes the most energy.
Interesting.
I'm thinking when I'm doing the handwork. It's sort of the rote, repetitious. I love sitting all day sewing beads or doing embroidery, usually in a quiet space, my design journal's nearby, and all kinds of new ideas are going through my head because my conscious mind is involved sewing the beads. I don't have to think about that. And once your conscious mind is involved, whether it's driving the car, weeding in the garden, doing dishes, you go to your subconscious, which is where all that creative, inspirational information is. So when I'm sewing the beads on, I'm looking around my studio and thinking, what would happen if I did a garment that? And I grab my little journal and I write down the idea. And my best ideas come when I'm doing rote things with my hand, which is also why the quiet time when I fly doing workshops around the country, people laugh because I've been doing this over 35 years. I have never, ever spoken to my seat partner. I take my seat in the plane. I have my design journal. I play like I'm busy. It's very easy. And I have a block of uninterrupted time to think. And you need that for creativity. And that's the hardest thing for any of us to acquire in today's world. Quiet, alone time just to think.
Right. Something that, again, isn't very valued in the American culture. You're supposed to be busy, 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 producing something all the time.
We're supposed to be productive, which is why I always loved canning when my children were young, because I could spend all day canning, line up the jars, and look at them and point to what I had achieved for the day versus cooking or cleaning or the rest of it. And it's still hard for me, that old Puritan ethic. You cannot play until your work is done. Well, your work is never done.
Exactly.
But the end of a day of struggling with a design project, and I've had dyes out and fab, and nothing is working, and I'm totally discouraged. And the first thought is, I've wasted today. And the other side of my head knows better than that and says, well, of course not. This is the process you go through to find the answer to the question that you have on this piece you're trying to put together. But it's hard to go through a whole day and you've rattled around the studio and there's no wonderful, grand, award-winning garment or wall piece to share. But that is part of the process for me.
Well, on the drive up to Anacortes, I had a lot of time to think because inspired by your talk, I did not turn on the radio and I just thought. And I got a lot of great ideas. And one of them was the fact that in our culture, artists aren't really valued until they're successful. It's as if the artistic process itself is just playtime, silliness, not really valuable until you become the award-winning artist, until you're on the cover of Time.
Because what that means then that there is money involved. And so now you're validated because what you do generates this kind of price or income by the buying public. So we have a direct connect in this culture between what you do and what it is monetarily worth. And I am frequently asked the question, how long did that take you? And my answer is always the same, and it's this: I don't know. I don't need to know because I do not sell my garments. I create one-of-a-kind, simple-shaped, contemporary garments inspired by other cultures and peoples and times. I make them as my wardrobe. I create garments to give to people I love, for exhibition, and for teaching. If I were selling, it would be essential I knew how long it takes to do it. The other thing I try to share with people is, for me, it's like reading a really good book. And when someone says, how long did it take you to read that book? We kind of shrug and say, we have no idea, because it was just this joyful time. And that's how I feel about the creating of the garments. I know how long it takes to clean the bathroom because I do not like to do that. And I know how long it takes to go to the store and get groceries because I don't like doing that either. But how long did it take to sew those 1,000 beads on that garment? I don't know. It was just a wonderful journey. People have a difficult time recognizing that I'm doing what I'm doing with the hours involved, and I do not sell them. But I am so privileged as a woman and an artist that I can eat without having to use the work of my hands to buy groceries. And most of us do not have that privilege. I am very blessed. It doesn't matter to me if something takes 2 months or 2 years. It's the journey, and I do not have to worry about the time involved. I don't care how long it takes.
Instead of selling the garment, you are selling your experiences that you gain from the garment with your teaching and your workshops.
Exactly.
And your lectures.
I would not be able to support myself doing the workshops and the lectures and the books. It is like one artist said years ago, was interviewed, could she support herself with the work of her hands? And she said, well, yes, she could, as long as there was no repair on the car, the furnace did not break down, and she did not have to have health insurance. She could indeed support herself. And I'm in much the same situation. The teaching and the books have added income, which has been wonderful. It's allowed a lot of privileges. It's allowed some extras in my life. But I could not live on the income from doing that for the amount that I teach.
That's so common. And that's one of those dirty little truths that most people don't talk about. For example, I've published 5 books with New York publishers, but there is no way I could support myself on what I've earned. And my husband has published 7 books. So we're both successful writers, and we couldn't make a living wage. It's interesting.
It's challenging, discouraging all at the same time.
What I've had to come to terms with is I may never make a living with my art or my podcast or my writing or whatever. But it is so important to my soul to do this work. And as you said, to use it to express myself in the world, that even if I have to work at Walmart, I would keep doing this.
I have shared exactly the same thing. And as I said in the guilt book, I have been supported by a patron of the arts. His name was Jack Mayer. It's the man to whom I was married. You know, bless him. We all need a patron. If I indeed needed to generate more money, it would never be through the work of my hands. I grew up working in my dad's grocery store. I'd go back and clerk in a grocery store in order to have the freedom to do what I do with my creative background. As I tell people, it's not that I want to weave or that I want to make garments. I have to. It's my soul. It's who I am. As I breathe, I have to be creative. And I would find a way to make that happen, doing, as you said, working wherever I need to work, doing whatever I have to do to have the freedom to pursue my creativity.
I think that's very important. My husband and I, the way we've worked it out is we each take 5 years, and one of us works and the other one's at home.
Wonderful.
And when we were in our 20s, it was like, of course we're doing this until we break out with that big novel, but now we're just doing it. Lately, your focus has been more on embroidery than weaving. What drew you into that art form?
I have the wonderful first bleached dish towel that I embroidered when I was 6 or 7, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you know, with Lazy Daisy. So my first introduction to working with my hands was with my mom in embroidery. So I've always loved that. And even when I began weaving, I made simple fabric. I always say woven plain weave fabric. And then I rewarded myself by embroidering all over it or adding mirrors or making it special. So I created the canvas in which to adorn and embellish. I knew early on that's what I loved. And after I did the 7 years of embroidery and design, I recognized that I'm happiest with a needle in my hand, whether it's hand embroidery or beading. I have made friends with my sewing machine and I do some free machining, but if someone said, what do you want to do all day? I want to sit in the studio in quiet and embroider or bead. That really shifted me a bit away from weaving. I will never relinquish my loom and I will always do some weaving. But it occurred to me to take simple fabric. I'm changing it anyway by painting it, dyeing it, embellishing it, appliquing on it. So I don't need to make the fabric myself any more than a weaver has to raise sheep in order to weave, when a painter does not have to make the frame in order to paint. I've given myself permission, when appropriate, to use commercial fabric and adorn it in lieu of making all the fabric I work with. So it really, from the earliest times, it was simply my own evolution, realizing through going to class how much I do love embroidery. So why not design garments that allows me to do that?
We don't have time to describe all the richness and details of each of the garments you've made, and I feel bad for the listeners because they're missing out on this. If they wanted to view some of your art garments, where could they go to see these things?
I will have 3 pieces as part of a group exhibition at the Museum of Northwest Art in La Conner. The show opens, I believe, in March and runs through June. They can contact the Museum of Northwest Art. So 3 of my newest pieces will be in that exhibition. And in the spring of 2008, the Quilt Museum, again in La Conner, and they do have webpage, will have a one-woman exhibition there. So all of the important pieces over the last 3 years will be on exhibition in La Conner, which is probably accessible. I will be having a show next fall in October at the Fine Line Gallery in St. Charles, Illinois, a one-woman exhibition. So my friends in that part of the country can see the work there.
And you also have some pieces in permanent collections?
What I am doing with my major pieces, once I have published or shown them, is I'm donating them to textile collections. The Mantles for Women, the series of the 6 long vests, are now at Kansas State University in Manhattan, Kansas. They have established and are establishing a contemporary wearable art collection, which is being utilized by their design students, women's study groups. We had just an extraordinary exhibition there with those pieces when I donated them. All of the work from the first book and pieces from the second book are now at a Florida Institute of Art, which again is working with design students collecting contemporary garments. The body of work I'm doing now, which will be shown for the next 3 years, my plan is when I am through showing that work, is I want to find a national organization that supports women, whether it's domestic violence, it's helping women find careers. I don't know yet what it will be, but I want these pieces to go to those kinds of organizations where they can auction them off and raise money to support their cause. So my children have no reason to keep these. Once I've shown them, I would sometimes wear them a few times, but I want them out there. There's no way I can put a price on them, but I can give them to support women's efforts through the world. So that's the current plan.
Wonderful. You're such a busy and inspired lady. What is next for you?
More of what I'm doing. My life today as a widow is to spend the time doing my creative work and traveling and enjoying my family. What I have done for years, even when Jack was living, my goal was to go to work at 9 o'clock in the morning. I always got up early, got done what needed to be done, and I went to work at 9, which happened to be down the hall to my studio. And I literally would stay there till 4 in the afternoon. I basically do that 40 weeks out of the year. I travel in teaching and doing overseas textile tours about a total of 12 weeks out of the year. My time is in my studio with my family, and fortunately all 3 children are in the Seattle area. So I go there, they come here to visit. and overseas textile tours. And that's what gives me joy, and I'm going to do that as long as humanly possible. I moved into the townhouse that I'm now in, and there were three stipulations from my realtor, the first being studio space, the second being something I could afford, and the third was no maintenance outside. I'm 74 years old, and I know that there are only that many years on the other side, and I have places to go and things to create. So that's what I am doing and plan to continue doing.
You have a textile tour coming up to Morocco?
Well, actually, I just returned 2 weeks ago from a textile tour to Morocco. We had 20 people there for 14 days. It was an extraordinary experience. The tours I do, they are always focused on looking at a culture through the work of people's hands, men and women. So it's crafts and textiles. We had such a glorious time that I'm already organizing one for next November. We're adding several days because our time at the Sahara Desert was so extraordinary. We want another day there and another day at Aswaria, which is on the water. I'm already putting that together. In February, I'm going back to India for the fifth time, but this time with an invited group of 12 women. Our focus there are the women of India. We're going to the northwest corner of India. It's called Gujarat, Rajasthan. And it is set up to meet with as many cottage industry groups as we can that are helping women have income from the work of their hands. But even more importantly, we're going into villages, sitting down with the women, having them teach us everything from tie-dye to mirrored work, to embroidery, to block printing. So it's a hands-on, intimate look at that culture. I love it more than probably anywhere I've been. Most of the people going with me have been to India before, and we will be there 4 weeks with the pre-tour, 3 weeks on the main tour. So it's very intense. And I just last week signed up for a cruise to Alaska in July, which along with the cruise will be three instructors from England. These are the women who teach the City and Guilds program there, while I took one over here. And they are my mentors in terms of the work they do and the books they've written. So I will now have sessions with some of the gurus of the England embroidery world. So my plate is full of wonder for the coming year, but all the days between, I'll be in the studio working.
Do you have any spots left in any of those tours?
The Morocco tour for next November is certainly open. I'm just starting to advertise that. We will be taking 20 people. It'll be 15, 16 days in length. Again, we will be focusing on the work of people's hands in that culture. The tour person I work with is called Melly. It's Melly Tours. I've traveled with her about 8 years. We will have our own bus, and we are going to again explore Morocco. So I am more than interested in people contacting me if indeed this is something they would like to know more about.
Okay, I'll have a link to that on the show notes. So if you're interested in a fabulous tour, please check that out. Thank you very much for inviting me into your studio and for talking to us.
I am truly honored to have this opportunity and encourage women everywhere to take the time for their own souls and their own work, even if it's 15 minutes a day. Go for it.
Coming up, we've got a swatch of the day by Sharon Schultz. Sharon describes taking on a big project as a relatively new weaver and the unexpected rewards of biting off more than you can chew. After she finishes telling us about her project, I'll be back with today's audio essay, Weaving Resolutions.
Hi, Sign. This is Sharon, and here's my story of weaving that ended up being more than I ever imagined it could be. I was a fairly new weaver, had only been weaving about 2 years, and I was looking around in church and I thought, you know, I could make a banner for church. That would be lovely. I go to a very tiny church that has a very small building, and I thought that a banner would brighten things up. I was telling some members of the congregation, who also happened to be on the altar guild and on the church council, about the possibility, and they thought it was a great idea. They also started talking about what poor condition our pyramids are in. Pyramids are altar cloths, and they decorate the altar and the place where the preacher preaches, the place where the lessons are read from, and stoles are often part of pyramids. And the idea is that they decorate and give us clues about the season and help contribute to our worship. So I thought, I could weave some pyramids. I have a baby wolf with a 26-inch weaving width, and I thought, And so I figured out ways that I could weave all of the pyramids and get the shapes and the sizes they needed to be. But the main reason that I decided that I would weave some pyramids is that the previous set was very old and very ugly. It was stained, especially the cloth that covered the top of the altar. The pieces were mismatched. For example, every red piece was different than every other red piece. Several were damaged. The worst of all, though, was that they didn't fit. They were too large for our rather small altar. The altar guild did the best they could, though, and they scotch taped them to the altar. Scotch tape! I couldn't believe it. It was awful. They were hand-me-downs, and they were just in bad shape. So I said, okay, I'll do this. I can make the 6 sets needed for the church year. And while I'm at it, I'll make stoles for the pastors also. And the game was on. 10 months later, I had a lot of really imperfect cloth, but I was a much, much better and more experienced weaver. There were a lot of patterns I would have never tried because I would have never had a reason to make them. I was planning all the time during that 10 months. I would plan during the sermon. I would plan during the prayers in church. I would plan while I was at work. I would plan while I was driving. I planned at the grocery store. When I fell asleep at night, I was planning. When I woke up in the morning, I was full of ideas. It pretty much filled my head for that 10-month period. But finally, after weaving and agonizing and sampling and sampling and sampling and emailing with friends and showing friends and asking for advice and then deciding to do what I wanted anyway, I was finished. I know exactly the minute that I finished because it was half an hour before I was meeting the pastor at the church to set them up for a dedication service that was going to be held on July 31st. I was to meet her at 2:30. It took me 20 minutes to get there. And I finished at 2 o'clock, sewing on the last label. My father was here, which was very exciting, so he went with me. We had thought of a way to display them so that in the dedication service, when we sort of walked through the church year, we could show all of the pyramids hanging. But in figuring the way to display them out, I made another discovery. It's an example of the kind of inspiration and the way that this was more than anything I could have thought of on my own. Some seasons in the church year show up more than once. The red pyramids are up at 2 different times during the year. The green pyramids are up at 2 distinct times of the year. Others, like the purple set and the blue set, just show up once. It turns out that for everything that showed up more than once, I had made 2 pieces to hang on the altar. For everything that just showed up once, I had just made 1 long piece that would hang across the altar. I didn't intentionally do that. It just turned out that way, and I didn't even realize it until we were setting up. So I was really kind of impressed that all these cool things had happened, completely apart from anything I had consciously done. And I thought, well, that's very exciting. We've had this lovely service, and now I'm done. But I wasn't. Because I'm a little bit of a pack rat, I had taken pictures of everything along the way and compiled them into a book that explained just in very brief detail how weaving works and then explained some of my thoughts and impressions and intentions of the pyramids and how the colors went with the season and how the weave structure complemented the color. So I had used my Mac and iPhoto to make some books. And the books cost about $45 each. I thought I would make one for myself, one for my church, and we would be done. But in fact, 10 people, not even including people related to me, wanted to buy copies of those books. It was a shock. But I thought, well, how about that? They want books. How lovely. And off I went. But the congregation was so happy that they called the newspaper. Now, I live near the state capitol, and the newspaper in the state capital is the big newspaper, and that's the newspaper they called. And they did it just in a city section for my particular area. The reporter called, talked to the reporter for several hours, explaining what I had done, why I had done it, met her at the church. A photographer came, and there was a photo shoot, and I've never felt like such a model. That was lots of fun. They put color pictures with the article, which spanned part of two pages in the newspaper. And I thought, well, haven't been in the newspaper in a long time. How nice. Maybe now it's done. But it wasn't, because I went to my weaving guild locally. There's only one. It's not a terribly large group. I had been when I first started weaving, but I really didn't know enough to get the most out of it. But after this experience, I thought, well, I'm a little more experienced. So I took some things that I had recently woven, thinking that that would always be a good conversation starter. I went, and I was showing my show and tell, and there was great excitement. There was all of this welcome. I was at the end of this, and I sort of sheepishly said, well, and I also did this big project for my church, and they did an article on me in the paper. Well, the woman who does the programs leaped out of her chair and said, I've been looking for you. I was trying to find out who you were. I didn't know that was you. We want you to do a program. And then another woman came up and said, you know, I'm Lutheran too. Will you come do a program for my church explaining these pyramids? And that's when I thought, you know, maybe this wasn't just all going to go away. So shortly after all of this had happened, that I was listening to the Weavecast, and I was thinking, you know, I have a story. I have a story kind of like these stories Sign tells. I wonder if anybody would be interested in my story. And then Sign started talking about the bribe of matter roots to people who would call and give their stories. Well, it turns out that at the Weaving Guild meeting I went to, the program was given by a young man, a 22-year-old man from Oaxaca, Mexico, who is studying and working hard to revive the art of natural dyes done with non-toxic mordants, so that his family, which is a family of weavers, would not be endangered. He had gorgeous stuff, and it was so inspiring. And I thought, inspiration, matter roots, my story, it just all seemed to fit. So here's my story. And the moral is, never think you are too inexperienced, or too old, or too young, or too anything. Just weave from your heart, and they will come.
Today's audio essay, Weaving Resolutions. Now I'm going to confess here, I am not a huge fan of New Year's resolutions, largely because I don't like disappointing myself. But this year there are some things I want to accomplish. Inspired by Anita, I want to create a hand-woven garment. I've been weaving for 3.5 years and I haven't ever really woven something I could wear, I mean, aside from a shawl or a scarf. I want to weave something that's an actual shirt or jacket or skirt or pants. I haven't decided what yet, but I'm going to weave something for my wardrobe, and I'm going to add some meaning to it, even if it's just a small flourish, even if I just write my name on the hem in a Sharpie. I've got some thinking to do there, but I want to weave something that represents me, and when I wear it, I feel like I'm being honest with the world. In a more prosaic weaving resolution, I want to get cracking on that COE sample work. I recently had the wonderful opportunity of being a scribe for the COE, and it impressed me both in the amazing quality of the samples that I saw and also the number of them. And I'm looking at the 2 years I have to do the samples, and I realized I have to produce a finished sample every 2 weeks to get this done by 2008. So I'm going to try to do a sample a week, because I know that life is going to intervene about 50% of the time. So I figure if I strive for a sample a week, then maybe I'll get one done every 2 weeks. That's my goal. Resolution number 3, yarn diet. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just recently finished rearranging a room in my house to be a weaving studio, and I promised my husband that all of the fiber tools would be contained in this one room. And there's more fiber here than there is room. So I am going to try to either sell on eBay, use up, or give away some of this stash. But I have a plan. I have a strategy. I figure if I weave really fast, especially things like bulky blankets that use a lot of yarn, that I will be converting stash into household linens. And household linens do not have to live in my weaving room. They live in linen closets and on beds. So this is my plan. Lots of big, bulky blankets. Resolution number 4. I'm going to do WeaveCast for another year. I just paid my internet service provider for another year of hosting. I like to buy it annually because it's cheaper. I am just thrilled and delighted to be able to say that a year's worth of server hosting fees have been covered by my donating listeners and sponsors. You guys are awesome. I really appreciate the help with the show. I gotta keep doing it because you guys have invested in WeaveCast, so I can't quit because I have to make sure you get your money's worth. So here's hoping you feel like you're getting your money's worth, and a big thank you for all the support in 2006. So those are my 4 weaving resolutions. Hand-woven garment, COE samples, yarn diet, WeaveCast. What are your weaving resolutions? What do you want to do with your bright and shiny new year? I'd love to hear from you, either in the comments or through audio or on the voice line. 2007 is just beginning, but it's only 365 days long. So let's get cracking and get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave. I'm going to play you out with a fun song in honor of the new year. This is called New Year's Song by the Schlumpkin Sisters.
New Year's is approaching and we're all abuzz. 'Cause 07 can't be worse than 06 was. Oh. Cruise jumped on Oprah's couch, went after Brooke Shields, what a grouch, proved he's the nunniest guy on earth, when he and Katie had a silent birth. Mel Gibson got pulled over by the fuzz, 'cause he was driving really buzz, checked into rehab to kick the boost, but what's he gonna do about hating Jews? Jews. Last year, with a lot of crapola, dealing with the Ayatollahs, paid $3 a gallon for our gas. Last year was a real humdinger, Paris Hilton thinks she's a singer, hope next year is better than the last. Hope next year is better than the last. Foley's IMing congressional pages, asking for picks and what their ages. A lot of elections were uncontested, 'cause half of Congress got arrested. Approval ratings are down for Bush, doesn't seem to know his head from his tush. The president may not be too brainy, but he's smart enough not to hunt with Cheney. Last year was a real humdinger, Paris Hilton thinks she's a singer, polar ice caps are melting fast. Last year was a lot of crapola, dealing with the Ayatollahs, hope next year is better than the last. I hope next year is better than the last. I hope next year is better than the last.
WeaveCast is brought to you through the generosity of our donating listeners and sponsors. Thank you. You guys keep the lights on and help me buy equipment upgrades. I couldn't have done this first year's worth of shows without you. You're awesome! The expenses for this episode were underwritten by Mud River Angoras, specializing in Angora spinning fiber and weaving yarns, and now offering pre-wound weaving kits. In addition, I'd like to thank the artists who share their work on the PodSafe Music Network. This episode, we played the Schlumpkin Sisters with New Year's Song, and our transitional music was Raining Colors by Torchomatic. Both are available on the PodSafe Music Network.